Hello, everyone, and welcome to Evenings with an Author at the American Library in Paris. My name is Emily Biggs. I'm the programs manager here at the library. And tonight, I am so delighted and thrilled to be joined by our brilliant writer-in-residence, Patricia Lockwood, for part one of two events. Patricia will be returning tomorrow as well, so don't miss that. But tonight, we will be discussing her brilliant two books, No One Is Talking About This and Priest Daddy. This conversation, as well as tomorrow's, is organized as part of a larger festival this month called Reverberations, which is celebrating interactions in storytelling and sound. Patricia's a beautiful poet, and as you will see when she reads for us, there's a wonderful musicality to her work as well. So if you've joined us for other Reverberations events this past month, thank you so much, and keep stay tuned for programming announcements to come. Just a couple notes before we get started. Copies of Patricia's brilliant books are for sale thanks to our brilliant partner booksellers, Smith & Sons. So if you would like to purchase your copies, I highly encourage you to do so after the event. This event will also be followed by a reception, which has been very generously sponsored by the De Groot Foundation. The De Groot Foundation also sponsors the Writer-in-Residence program that we offer, which has permitted us to host Patricia for these wonderful couple of weeks. We're very thankful for that. After about 45 minutes, we will open this conversation up to questions from our in-person audience and our Zoom audience as well, if we have time. Hello, Zoom audience. Thank you for joining us tonight. So start thinking of your questions now. On to our wonderful author speaker tonight. Patricia Lockwood is the author of four books, including No One Is Talking About This, an international bestseller, winner of the Dylan Thomas Prize, finalist for the Booker Prize, and translated into 30 languages. Her 2017 memoir, Priest Daddy, won the Thurber Prize for American Humor and was named one of The Guardian's 100 best books of the 21st century. She has two poetry collections, Motherland, Fatherland, Homeland Sexuals. I almost missed it. Very important. And Balloon Pop Outlaw Black. Lockwood's work has appeared in the New York Times, The New Yorker, and the London Review of Books, where she is a contributing editor. She lives in Savannah, Georgia, with the exception of these past couple of weeks when she has been living in Paris, France, with us. Patricia's two books, if you haven't had the pleasure of reading them, are miraculous, hilarious, genius, poetic, tragic. She encompasses everything in them, and it's been such a pleasure to get to know her over these past weeks as well, and to see her brilliance, her magnetism in person. So Patricia, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Give me a round of applause, please.
Thank you, Emily. I shouldn't have sat down so quickly because I felt like I was proposing to you as you towered above. But yes,
now
we're on an equal. I accept. Yes, absolutely. Thank you for the wonderful introduction and for having me to the library. It's been lovely so far. I have like a little zoo downstairs. So I go in there and I lock myself like in a glass room and you can come see me at work. Like,
you can bang on the glass if you want.
You literally can. Yes. I've like set up my little things. I've hung a spoon on the wall. So everything.
Three times a day we feed her.
Yeah,
toss a live rat in there.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. That's right.
We're going to start with a reading from Patricia's brilliant book, No One Is Talking About This.
At the Archaeological Museum, they stepped from a room full of airy beaten gold and into the tannic darkness where the bog bodies were. An informational plaque informed them that one particular bog body had had its nipples cut off, since sucking a king's nipples was a sign of submission in ancient Ireland. A little boy stood weeping before the exhibit, his older brothers in a ring around him, laughing. The bog body's first finger was raised as if to post. The dark brown nippleless torso twisted and twisted in the dark. It could never be king of anything now except the little crying boy. And what do you have to say about this? A woman in New Zealand demanded, presenting her with a folded and clearly cherished clipping from the Telegraph in which it was reported that 1 in 8 young people had never seen a cow in real life. On the Isle of Skye, she and her husband ate langoustines at a restaurant overlooking a long gray ridge of rock with a lighthouse at the tip of it, and laughed at the herds of tourists who insisted on visiting lighthouses wherever they went. Some things, her husband whispered, are the same no matter where you go. But later, taking an afternoon out of the portal to read Virginia Woolf, She realized that that must have been it, the lighthouse the family sails to on the final page. Was that the final page? Or did the book end with herself and her husband cracking the red backs of little sweet creatures, cutouts of each other and all the same, and laughing at the people who moved in one wave, the family who went to the lighthouse? Your attention is holy, she told the class as her phone buzzed uncontrollably in her back pocket for a long-ago joke she had made about a Florida politician, quote, who nearly died during elective taint-lengthening surgery, unquote, was receiving renewed attention that morning. It is the soul spending itself, she continued, closing her eyes to see something else, and describe to them the remote monastery she had visited the year before. It overlooked sheets of fresh lavender like higher laundry, and opalescent slugs crept through the rain toward it on pilgrimage. And inside, there was an underground room where the monks gathered every evening to study scripture in silence. They sat in a circle in the cool scoop of the room, their baldnesses bowed together and red. The floor sloped, seeming to pour toward one white prismatic corner that passed the world through itself like a perfect quartz sphere. There was no reason it should look so solid, but it was where all that reading had gone. That was a good selection. I don't think I've ever done that out like as a reading before. I thought that was good.
You saw it here first at the American Library. First, this is a reason
American
to come
Library,
to our
right. Unprecedented. Absolutely.
So for those who haven't had the immense pleasure of reading this book, it's all like that. It's just funny and wacky and inappropriate and fragmented, and then suddenly it just smacks you with something absolutely brilliant, and you're kind of stunned by that, and then it slaps you again with a woman screaming at you about cows.
Yeah. It's a bludgeoning. It's a sort of bludgeon instead of, you know, like a novel, really. It's it's quite forceful.
Quite violent, yes. Yeah. Yes. And so the title of the talk tonight, this conversation, is Writing Now, and I've stolen that, obviously, from an essay that you wrote, which is entitled, How Do We Write Now? Mm-hmm. And that's also the question that you seem to be asking over and over again. So this is a book about a woman. She's as the kids say, she's very online. She plugs herself into the portal. The portal is the internet. She's constantly tweeting. She's constantly sharing. She's there. She's in it. And she's constantly asking, what is it like to live now? She then asks, what is it like to have a baby now? And I like this because when you think about writing now, you think about the experience of the presence, but you also think about what it means to actually articulate what now is. Mm-hmm. And you've spoken about this in interviews before, that you are not interested in disengaging from the world, burying your head in the sand, yet there's also a sort of danger of the appeal of the now that it calls to you, the sort of tyranny of the moment. So could you tell us a bit, as you were writing this book and your previous book and as you write your essays, how you're positioning yourself in relation to now?
Yeah. Well, what I saw happening around me was what you say. It was this kind of eternal minute where you were always there. It was always the present. The same thing seemed to be happening to all of us at the same time, like we were in this pool together. And no one was writing a single freaking thing about it. You know, it would be like if the invention of the telephone didn't make it into novels for like 25 years. And it seemed to me, since what it was, I was driving my entire day down into this, you know, you would like disappear into it. Like, what am I doing with my days that needs to be set down for people 100 years from now, 150 years from now? So since I read historically, I really came up not reading so much contemporary literature as literature from the past, I've always had a very long mind. I never really wanted to exist in my present time, but I saw for the first time that I truly did. And I thought, it needs to be recorded. It needs to be recorded for that person in 100 years. It might not make sense to them then. They might not have any knowledge of what we were thinking, what we were feeling, but we can put details there. You can write these things down. So it became, I don't know why I decided to do it. It seemed foolhardy. You know, people really didn't want it to be written about. I had a strong feeling. Do you have that feeling, like from the past 10 years, that we were all doing this thing at the same time, but no one really wanted to admit it or set it down in any sort of concrete way?
We're not supposed to talk about it.
Yeah.
It's dirty and it's embarrassing.
It's private.
Not literary. It's
exactly.
Not high-minded.
It was not literary. And I always had a really strong sense as a child of what was not literary. Since I was reading older books, since it was like, you know, the classics poetry shelf at the Barnes & Noble, things from 100 years ago, I was like, well, there can't be a Kmart in it, and there can't be a McDonald's. Like, no one can eat a Big Mac. I can't talk about trademarks. I can't use the word Kleenex. I had this very, very strong idea that you couldn't do those things. And I recognized this in myself when I started to write, and I thought, well, what if I went to the opposite end and really wrote about the thing that you're not supposed to talk about, like the dirty thing that we're all, like the hole we're all falling into, right? The dirty hole, yeah.
The thing that we all see, but that we don't have the words to talk about
yet.
It's interesting then that in writing now, you're not necessarily writing for now, you're writing for the future.
You're writing for posterity. So there was a strong feeling with this novel, particularly that it was written in internet language, which is not, I don't think, the case. You have to write in a kind of permanent language, and you can translate certain things for that you know, future audience, and you can write about these ephemeral things, but it has to be done, I think, in a language that lasts. And for me, that's kind of the poetic language. That's the one that's lasting.
And what do you understand this language to be in contrast to the internet language? What might internet language look like versus permanent language?
I think that there's a different kind of music. And it was not something you always knew at first. Sometimes you would make an observation about something that was happening online, and you would think for a while, that's really funny, that's really poignant. And then after, you know, 6 months, a year, you were like, no, that doesn't need to be in it. So you can just throw that away. That's fine. So it was really like a process that time performed for me. I wrote down the ephemera. I thought maybe this will be important later. Maybe this will be something I can use. It was like gathering, scrapbooking. And then later it was like certain things were winnowed or wafted away. Like they didn't appear to be part of it. You can't make your language poetic in the same way that you can't make a joke be funny. It sort of arrives in that way. There are things that you can do to shape it, but if something's funny, it arrives funny. If something is poetic or lyrical, it arrives that way too.
This is perhaps a mean question, but do you think that this book came out several years ago, do you think that the language has lasted? When you revisit it now, do you feel that it's still speaking that eternal language?
Oh, this presupposes that I revisit it, which I do not.
Can you bear to read your own book?
No. I look at this and I'm like, what is this thing? You know, I actually spoke to the designer of this at the Booker party where I lost. So what happens after the Booker is there are five simultaneous parties going on around the city for each of the finalists. As soon as one of the people wins, everyone leaves the other parties and they go to that party. So they all flee to this party, but you have to stay at your own party and you're just trapped in this place, like being a loser, right? Being like, oh, I guess we didn't win. Sorry, everyone. And I spoke to the designer and I was like, man, what, you probably didn't enjoy just like slapping a rainbow on the cover. And he was like, no, it's the most boring book I've ever done. I was like, so I look at it and it doesn't feel like the book. When I read something out loud from it, I'm like, okay, like I remember that, I remember composing it, or I remember living it. But what I think is important about it now is that like the place that it describes is died, like, or is in the process of dying. So Twitter was active. It was a toxic cesspool at the time of this book's writing, and it was absolutely like a garbage hole and full of sludge. But it was alive. You could still go there to, say, get news about, like, a bridge collapse in Baltimore. You can't do that anymore. It's not useful for that. So then it becomes not a matter of is the language permanent, but this is an artifact, you know, of a very short scene where we were present for a while, and now that cafe has been torn down. That public square no longer exists.
Did you see the collapse of Twitter coming?
Yeah. I felt it. So my feeling about Twitter was that it was already sort of overripe by 2016, right? So Donald Trump is elected president, and a place that was kind of already past its time was elevated into new prominence because that's where he decided to set up his office. It became this gold tower that he was, you know, issuing his pronouncements from the top of, and it was really, really horrible. And I think it was extended past its natural life. You know, like, so social media platforms, these places only last so long, and then everyone kind of naturally migrates somewhere else. For Twitter, the process has been very like artificial. It's been violent and forceful with the takeover of Elon Musk. That was a violent takeover. And so it was ended in a way that I did not see that coming. There are times that I thought, well, that's something I would have liked to, you know, describe or put into the book, but there's something nice also about the fact that it was alive at this point. We hated it. We hated every single second we were there, and we were like, get me out of this. I want this to not exist anymore. But when it's gone, you're like, well, what is that place now?
Where does that thought go? Where do those words
right,
go?
Right. Or the communal thought. Like, there's sort of a communal lifeblood pumping through that place. There was a conversation that was going on at all times. If you had insomnia in the United States, you would pick up your phone and you would be treated to what Australians were feeling. You were like, oh, okay, this is what's going on in Australia. It was always ongoing, which was part of the danger, because you could at any point short circuit boredom, which, as we've discussed, is the beginning of creativity. You could short circuit this boredom and you could just go into that place where conversation was happening without you having to speak. It was going on outside of you, and you felt kind of carried along by this electricity or this aliveness in the world.
I have two things to say to that. The first is, there's this brilliant moment in No One Is Talking About This, when this sort of, for those who haven't read the book, like, disaster kind of strikes, and it lurches the narrator out of the portal, out of the world that she's living in. You write it as, she fell out of the warm, hot us. And indeed, it feels like this warm, hot us that is this sort of incessant stream of speech into which one can dip in and out. I can't remember the second thing.
I was like, that got away from you. That sort of slipped out of it. But it was like this amniotic feeling. You describe it two ways. It sort of felt like a womb, but it also felt like you were falling. There was something about the physical act of doing this and this and this. It was like this long, endless sort of, you know, like Dorothy, like a little bit of a Wizard of Oz, like fall just endlessly, and you could just keep going. And you weren't going exactly into your own mind, but it was kind of hard to pinpoint exactly where you were.
I've remembered my train of thought as we talk about streams. and I want to talk about attention and relate it to what you were saying about boredom. So you're saying boredom is the sort of starting point of all creativity. I see this as related to what you've written in the book, which is that your attention is holy. It reminds me as well of what you write in How Do We Write Now? You say, the first necessity is to claim the morning, which is mine. If I look at a phone first thing, the phone becomes my brain for the day. If I don't look out a window right away, the day will be windowless. The window seems to be the sort of portal of attention, of boredom as well. Can you speak about boredom and attention as they influence your creative work?
Yeah, so that's one of those essays that is heavily quoted in many places that I wrote on a plane because I had to deliver a speech the next day. So it's like, you never know what it's going to be that people resonate to or that they actually like. So I began as a poet, and there is something that happens in a long, sort of lazy wool-gathering space, which is that kind of just a slit will open up in the air, or there will be a spark off to one side. And it only happens in this sort of, like a thought bubble above the head, like a real thought bubble. And it only happens if you give it a little time and if you sit with it. But now there's this external thing that you can pick up and you can completely short circuit that process. I know for a lot of poets, it became more difficult to write poetry in those days. I knew poets who, after Trump was elected, didn't write another poem for like 4 years. And I think it's because, rather than sit with that, which is itself like a kind of discomfort that you have to undergo before the thing happens, you would just pick up this thing. And you would go into a place where the thoughts were being had for you. So, I mean, to have a thought, it's, you know, it's not an effortless process, right? It's still like an act of volition, like they float in and out of your mind, but it's still something that the self is doing. Whereas it's different in that place. So it became hard, I think, for a lot of us to sit with long spaces of time where you didn't know what was going to happen. Often what would happen in that space of time would be an idea, and I think we became maybe more uncomfortable with that, you know, that waiting for the idea.
You talk in Priest Daddy, you speak about your experience of writing the poem that sort of launched you into fame, which is a rape joke. And you say that a poem, it's like a peaceful companion. You sit alongside one another and read your novels for most of the time. And then at one point the conversation takes off and the spark alights.
Yeah, and it is very interesting. And the morning is so important. There's this line in Agnes DeMille wrote a really wonderful sort of autobiography of like her choreographing journey and process. And she wrote of a time that she could not think of any dances. She said, I could think of no good dances. But she said, I would wake up and I would have my coffee and I would move about in my morning. And I always mark that phrase because that's how it feels. You have to strongly mark the morning as yours. You know, whatever it means in terms of ritual, you have to make it yours. You can't immediately go into the place of other thoughts. It has to be something that's yours. And it was. I mean, there was something about writing a poem. It's unlike writing a novel. It's unlike writing an essay. It is just your companion. And it gives you something to think about and something to do for that time. It's like a kind of limerence, like being in love. And you think, I hope I don't get hit by a bus. I hope that I don't die before I finish it. Which you can think that about novels too, but it's not the same as the poem, you know, which can be written within a week and is just that hot, urgent feeling of this thing that's happening right now. Please don't let me die before the poem is finished, you know.
I want to talk more about your relationship to form. I know it's a question you get a lot, but you're at the American Library now and I've trapped you here, so yay. I'm gonna make you talk about it here as well. Yeah. I was struck by an interview you did with Sally Rooney where you wrote that a live form to me is one that I don't quite know how to use. It is like a new body. Whenever I found myself in a state of febrile excitement on the internet, it's been when I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
I was learning my way around, lifting up limbs, discovering their reflexes, making a place voluptuous. I mean, first of all, this is just delicious, beautiful writing.
Oh, thanks, because I was about to be like, wow, that's really purple girl. Like, rein it in, whoops.
But I'm struck by the fact that the internet in some way allowed you to discover this new way of movement, of moving your limbs around, and then maybe you've moved beyond that now?
Yeah, no, the internet is incredibly physical for me, and the thing that would excite me always about a new place, and the reason that I did feel like Twitter was kind of dying, was I felt this withering of the text box, of the page. So you go to a new place, and there is a new blank page, and a cursor like will be blinking right in one corner, and that's the thing that's alive. And you're like, anything. I could put anything in that box. So it's always the beginning for me that is very interesting because you can do anything within that space. After a while, it becomes formalized. You know the sorts of things that people say. You know the kinds of arguments they have. But there is a really brief period, usually toward the beginning, where no one knows quite what to do with it yet. And that's, for me, like the creative place. But I think because I work between forms and I don't like to think about genre or form necessarily in terms of like, what will this book be? Will it be a novel? You know, will it be a collection of essays? I'm just working almost myopically with the text itself, like letting it feel its way. I think that it's similar, maybe. It's like you don't know what something's going to be yet, right?
And there's also, as you say, you resist sort of genre classification that way, but you slip in your works between autofiction, if we can use that term, if that's still a stable category, memoir, poetry as well, and then the nonfiction essay. Can you talk about how you hit these different notes of bringing personal experience, the self, the I, into these different formal categories?
A lot of times it's just what is useful. So Annie Dillard, I think in her excellent book on writing, The Writing Life, just says spend it all. There, something else will come. Use what you have right now. Like, it is for this. This is why you have it. This is why it's here. Don't hoard things. Don't save them up against some future time. Spend it all. So I've really taken that prescription to life. It might also be an attention disorder, but it, you know, as I'm writing, I think there is something that applies here. This is something I'm thinking about now. Don't save it for elsewhere. It can go here.
Is there a way that we can use that to look at the sort of proliferation of thoughts and information that exist online? Because that's something that you are frequently concerned with in the book. It's you know, it's the title of the book. No one is talking about this. The narrator, as she's undergoing this personal crisis, this crisis in her family, she feels the need to share, and everyone else who's online needs to share too. And there's the sense that everything that is known has to be externalized, placed outwards.
Yeah, and it was one place where maybe the spend it all maxim did not really apply, because you would think when you were composing something in the text box, maybe I should save that for my book, right? That was the only time you were like, wait, no, put this in the book. It's more permanent. It's going in the book. But when it came, and I can speak, you know, autobiographically here, when it came to my niece, I thought, both, this is not my child. You know, this is a child with a rare genetic disorder that is going to prove fatal. You know, she's not my daughter. I can't exactly put her picture in this, you know, slipstream, this endless, you know, falling feeling of all events happening in the world at any given time. I can't do that, but I want to. And I think that was, spoke a little bit about like the holiness of the place, that you did want to maybe put the most personal thing there, that in the end I really wanted people to see her, right? So this was the face that was beloved, this was the face I saw every day, that, you know, rose in my mind's eye, that I was always thinking about, and why in this mind couldn't I put her there so that others could see her as well.
And so you put her in the book instead.
Yeah,
because in a sense the book and the portal are quite similar. They're the spaces where the inside thoughts go to be outside.
Right.
Yeah. And you talk in Priestaddy and in Known as talking about this, about the consequences of that, of putting what is real and what is in life into these virtual spaces, whether that's the page or the text. And so in Priestaddy, that's when you publish Rape Joke, and then you have this experience of coming downstairs and your mother has just read the poem, and you realize that what was in your head, what was artistic, is now going to affect the real people around you, the real life around you. Can you talk more about how you navigate that, the dissolution of that boundary between the unreal and the real?
I don't deal with it well. I mean, I don't know that anyone's dealing
I don't think anyone does.
Right. You don't think about it beforehand. You obtain permissions. You speak to people. Obviously, I asked my sister whether it was okay that I write about her and her child. She gave me permission. But with the other things, you can't think about that in advance, or it will inhibit you. It will change the writing. You have to really go into it like you go into a dark corridor and not think about those things. Be headlong, be heedless, be careful, you know, in terms of art, but not think about what lies at the other end. It can be very surprising. It can be shocking. You might not, you know, looking back, you might not do those things again had you known, but it's valuable that you did them. I mean, it's a feature of my life now, my artistic life, that I'll often be introduced in terms of Rape Joke, which is very, you'll be in Australia and the guy's like, and now the author of Rape Joke. And you're like, oh, that's something about me that is public now, that is a way that I'm introduced, you know, to audiences. And if you had that knowledge previously, you might not do that thing. But you also speak to people afterwards, you have people DM you, young girls, young women, men. Many people wrote me about Priestaddy who had experiences with, you know, being molested by priests as young boys. And so you think, all right, maybe you look back and you wouldn't have done those things, but some value, there is some value that is external to you that is not about your feelings, right? Like, I will pass away, all of these things will pass away. If there is comfort to be had, people will still have that comfort. That still stands.
Well, there's the tension between the work that is politically engaged. Mm-hmm. We return again to the idea of writing now. It's the work that speaks to now without being trapped in now, without being locked into these identity categories.
Yeah. Now, you were reading it recently. How did you feel? Did you feel that it had lapsed into a state of obscurity? Or did you feel a little bit, are we at that moment yet of nostalgia?
I did feel a bit nostalgic,
yeah,
I have to say.
I know, it's really sad. Because in the book, I do say, I'm like, you'll be nostalgic for this too, if we make it, right? And it comes to pass, like the pronouncement is fulfilled.
Yeah, and you do, you're very, very attentive in the book to the fact that, I think you say quite explicitly, the party is ending, the party is over, and that the book is, it's really, really funny, and it's really absurdly funny in the way that the internet was in like 2013, 2014.
Right.
and that humor's not quite as funny now because
no,
we've seen the consequences of it.
Yeah, so the way I put it was that like Gatsby is dead in the pool. Like there was, the party happened, but Gatsby lies dead in the pool. So, and you can't, but you have to also represent it as it was. which was this sort of manic champagne toasting supernova of a time. Like, you can't be untrue to it just because you see its demise sort of built into to those high spirits. You have to talk about it as it was.
Well, there's a sense in which, you know, I come from an academic background, and you see the theorists with capital T talking about the internet in that point in time as the perfect sort of space of mm-hmm. experimental creativity, absurdism. Like, all words are detached from their signifying relationships. Yeah. And then there are those that claim that that's what's responsible for the political collapse that followed. Do you buy into that narrative, that the sort of absurd space that we created online detached us from any possibility of objective truth in the real world?
I mean, that's a big question. You know, like, we do have these absurd periods basically concurrent with and leading up to fascist periods. So this exists in the world. This exists in history. To document it does not necessarily mean that you're causing it to happen. But yeah, it was a thing, and particularly on the left, there was kind of an unwillingness to believe that anyone had been manipulated. There was a very specific moment in time where everyone got emails telling them whether they had interacted with bots or not. And everyone I knew who had been having these online arguments, you know, like, got one of these emails, and I didn't, because I never argued online. So I was never arguing with a robot, right?
Learned from Patricia.
And I was very happy about that. I was like, okay, I didn't get the bot email, very good. But it's so easy, and I knew that it was so easy at the time, to just like drop a word like a stone into that place and see other people pick it up. You could be like, so you could just log in one day and be like, oh, I'm feeling awfully numinous this morning. And then later you would see someone use this word, or you would mention a song or some particular like photograph you would post, and then you would see it being disseminated. So I'm not gonna stand here and tell you that it was not possible to move human minds and human behavior with very, very tiny sort of forces, because I saw it happen. It was easy. But I mean, it was the place that we made. It was possible to do it in that place. I mean, this was our moment in time.
I'm gonna reference a meme, which I've never done before at the workplace, but I'm allowed to only
yes.
for tonight, because
it's
we're talking about
yes,
an internet book.
Yeah.
When I was online, my favorite meme was the Garfield meme, where he's grinning at you and there's text that says you are not immune from propaganda.
Yeah.
And in a sense, that's what we learned from this brief period of insanity on the internet, was
right.
that we thought we were safe in this unreal space, and in fact, we were not at all immune to the world.
We truly were not. And as we were discussing sort of during the pandemic, you really saw people who you thought were inoculated or immune being taken in by very, very strange things. The Johnny Depp Amber Heard thing, you know, the they're smuggling bodies in like Wayfair cabinets thing. You're like, well, maybe we're not as immune as we thought. I had always been a person who was on the margins observing human behavior. All human behavior seemed strange to me. Our institutions, our dialogues, our clothes, all of them seem very strange. I was a sort of depersonalized person who was like floating as a spirit among these concretions who seemed to know what they were doing and what they were about. So in that place, I felt that way too. I would make my contribution, but I would stand to the side as well and be like, do you know what it looks like? Do you know what you're doing? Do you know what forces you're subject to? Now, of course, someone standing on the other side of the room would be like, bitch, look at you, right? And they would know about me, but, you know, I had my own place to watch from.
Well, I do think your writing is compelling in that you resist identity. You speak mm-hmm. in pre-study about your suspicion about the we,
yeah.
and how you've been an observer of the we
yeah.
your whole life, and your ability to position yourself against or outside of the we.
Yeah.
Do you still occupy that stance today? Do you think the we is a dangerous place? Do you think it's possible
yeah.
to not participate in it?
I think I occupy it even more so. I do think that that Twitter period, or that, you know, golden internet era, that was a place where I really felt like these were my people. These are the brains in vats. These are the bodiless spirits who are all getting together to, you know, freak out and have a party. And to see what that became was very difficult, and it really made you question it. But I am very resistant always to groups, to joining, to unison, right? I mean, I was raised in that sort of weird Catholic evangelical Midwest moment of the 90s, where you were all supposed to join hands and like speak in tongues together. Like, once you've experienced that and your friends are like, blah, 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 you're like, oh, I have to distrust this, right? I have to distrust unison. I have to distrust what's happening here. That is what it was like. They were just like, blah, 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 blah.
So you've got such a compelling, diverse body of work. You have your books of poetry, you have Priest Daddy, which is a memoir written in the first person. You have No One Is Talking About This, which is inspired by life, but it is a novel as well. It's fictional. It's written from the third person. What was that decision to turn the I into a she for this book?
You know, you spoke about autofiction earlier as a stable or unstable category. Again, if you read historically, you're like, so much of the material, so much of the grist for the mill is always and has always been people's lives. So I didn't know what this book was as I began it. I liked the fact that you could sort of step out of the pronoun, because that's not exactly, you didn't exactly feel like an I in that place. You felt a little bit behind yourself, kind of watching. So I felt that that was useful, but I also felt that the fictionality allowed me to make clearer and perhaps like more honest observations than you can do if it was me. Because there is, I mean, you can get canceled. So I did think, you know, you do have more cushion, you do have more distance if it is the third person, if it is fiction, and then you can observe these things that otherwise perhaps you would want to step back from if they were yourself. But when it comes to the second half, I mean, you could have done some formal trick where suddenly it shifted into the eye, right? But that too felt a little bit like you were standing behind yourself watching something happen. These are both places where you're not exactly in your body, you know, the internet and this tragic event. You were not exactly there. So the she felt appropriate. It didn't necessarily seem like I was, you know, like fainting anything off or trying to defend myself. It was just a little bit how it felt.
You say in Pre-Study, the writers like being bodiless, mm-hmm. and that struck me as sort of your strategy. Yeah. And no one is talking about this, to be disembodied almost, to escape the body.
Yeah,
if only.
It's true. If I put a body part in there or like discuss someone's lipstick or hair color or something, it's always an act of will. I really do feel like I'm just like a walking column, really. I feel like I'm already dead and then I'm writing posthumously and I'm just like a walking column among like the fleshly living beings. Like I've always felt that way.
So our last gift from you was No One Is Talking About This. You are now locked in a glass room downstairs where theoretically you were meant to be writing things.
Yeah,
could you
forever.
Share with us what you're working on now?
Yes, yeah, so it's another form-breaking work where
Uh-oh.
That just means I don't know what to call it yet. but I wrote a bit about my experiences with this for the London Review of Books, where after I had COVID, I experienced psychosis. And talk about being depersonalized and bodiless or too much in your body. So I wrote a long novella about that called The Changeling that, again, was really trying to fix something in time that no one wanted anyone to write about. At the time, even, they were like, no one better write about this, please. No one wants to remember it. No one wants to look back. And I was like, but I have to. I mean, I had become insane. I was afraid of my floors. You know, I thought that my husband was faking his COVID and was like enjoying his life while he was actually in actuality crawling around on the floor like a dog about to, you know, cough up his own lungs. So I really had to just fix all that in the same way. I don't know if it's because maybe I had been doing that for the last book, really attuned to the grain of things and having to pay attention to things that other people were not paying attention to. And then it just became a mode, or if it was a way of trying to crawl back to myself, because there were things that remained intact. If I would read, I would mark the same passages. You know, if I read a play, I would hear the voices in the same way. There were things that seemed to remain stable or remain intact, and they all had to do with the literary self. So I thought that that was the way to talk about that or to make that permanent.
Has that frequently been your experience, that reading helps you locate the kind of stability, constancy of the self?
It always had been, but suddenly I couldn't read. And this was terrorizing to me. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Mary Ruffel, the American poet and essayist. You should have her here. She's amazing. She wrote a great book of essays called Madness, Rack, and Honey, in which she spoke about very suddenly, maybe in her 50s, she was unable to read. And she just floated high up off the page. And she said that later it turned out that she just needed glasses, but she was already gone She didn't read for 10 years. This is one of these extraordinarily, like, maximalist things that an American poet is given to doing. But you need glasses, you freak out, you don't read for 10 years. Right? It was one of those things.
Committing to the act.
Really committing to it. But I took comfort from that because I was like, it's so much a part of myself. Like, the thing that I think of as me is that I wake up in the morning and I open a book and I react to it. And my body responds to it. And my brain responds to it. If I don't have that, what am I as a person?
And then writing for you became a sort of practice of convalescence almost, so it brought you back to yourself.
Yeah, I still did it compulsively. I have the strangest notebooks from those times. They're written in an almost like fluorescent orange pen, which you can't even read. I have no idea why I chose this. And just page after page after page. And it still sounds like me. It's a little bit more high flown. Like, there's clearly, you've achieved a kind of like thinner air, right? You've climbed to some peak. You're not getting quite as much oxygen. But it was still recognizably myself. And the essay I wrote about it, I still sounded like myself. So you could look at these pieces as evidence that you still existed, that you were still there, that some part of you had not changed.
I would love to probe you more on that, but I have to turn you over to our audience and allow them to ask their questions. I have time for one more question on my end. And I've chosen a bit of an easy one, but you're famous for your tweets. Your tweets are very funny, and one of the tweets that you're famous for is a tweet at the Paris Review, where you say to them, "So is Paris any good or not?" So Patricia, is Paris any good or not?
How did I not see this coming? This is like the most intuitive thing to have happened. Yes, Paris is very, very good. I'm loving my time here, and I'm trotting around the streets. I have to tell you what I did. I have paid a debt to France. So I'm walking down the street near my hotel, the Rue Claire, and there is an old gentleman walking in front of me. He's very dapper. He's turned out for his evening stroll, and he has a huge bug on his head. And I don't know what to do. I don't know what is the etiquette in this situation. I can't let the bug continue to be on the man. It's like crawling in and out of his hair. It's on his scalp. So I like trot over to him. I can't remember the word for bug, so I'm like, linsect, scarabée. And I point to his head, and he's like, oh. And then I like walk toward this man with a little napkin I've got in my hand, and I lift the bug off his head, and then I release it in a bed of flowers next to him, and he says, oh mon Dieu, and he laughs, and I was like, finally, I have done something for France. I have given it something that it needed that it didn't know it needed. I have paid my debt, and now if I walk about and I'm awkward and I don't get the language right, I will know that I lifted the scarabée off the Frenchman's head, and thus I am no longer in France's debt. And that's how I feel.
Can we have a round of applause for Patricia Lockwood, please? If you have any questions for Patricia Lockwood, savior of Frenchmen, bringer of spring to the French lands, please raise your hand now. We'll start with in-person questions, and then we'll go to Zoom if we have time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From someone who is, I was going to say immune, who ignored the internet, anyway. But as a writer, why did you exclude anything that you wrote on Twitter, let's say, from being part of something literary?
That's an interesting question. I did feel like it was taking place in another sphere. And I also have the fear of self-quoting or reuse. There are a few passages, and no one is talking about this, that I think were taken from the way we write now during the editing process. I thought that those belonged. But no, I sort of felt like those were spontaneous pronouncements given to the people. And it would be not utterances of the character herself, right? So part of the trick with the book was that there's one famous post in it, and it's simply, "Can a dog be twins?" This is not something I ever posted, right? But it was something in the book that I was like, this is a plausible post, right? That a bunch of people see this and they repost, "Can a dog be twins?" But it couldn't actually be something I had really tweeted. It had to be something new and fresh that had sort of like that plausible deniability that this could be something that went in there. But it's a good question. And like I said, I did reserve things. Sometimes I would be like, almost all the way through, you're getting right to the character limit, and you're like, nope. that goes in the book, right? I'm saving that. So yeah, I did feel maybe that is the test that proves it to actually be fiction, that I felt it, you know, these were not pronouncements of the character. Ah, yes. I bet I can hear you.
First of all, just to expand, I have not stopped thinking about, can dogs be twins?
Right, I know. It's philosophical.
It's like an ongoing fight with my boyfriend about how I want Dalmatian girls from the same litter so I can name them Mary-Kate and Ashley.
Yeah.
But it's like, are they actually twins?
They couldn't be because the spots would be different, I'm afraid.
Well, you can, yeah. That's probably true.
So that settles your argument.
That does settle the argument. We will revisit that. But I was wondering if you could expand a bit on creativity coming from a place of boredom.
Mm-hmm.
I know you talk a lot in pre-study about like growing up in a religious household. Mm-hmm. It's something I can relate to. I grew up in an evangelical household in the Midwest. Yeah. And I felt so much creativity in that time of my life because of boredom and anger. Mm-hmm. And feeling a lot of just like rebellion against the systems around me. And now that you're an adult who can do pretty much whatever you want, yeah, whenever you want, how do you, I guess, find space for boredom? Is that still your process? Mm. And how do you make space for that while also like making space for like doing whatever you want and
yeah,
like having fun?
It's true. Well, you can cultivate it. You can cause yourself to be shut in a pen at the American Library in Paris and experience your boredom there. So you can, but actually a lot of it does involve like setting up these artificial situations for yourself where you're not looking at stimulus, you know, where you're setting yourself apart. But I think you're really right. Like boredom becomes something that works for us, or it's the place in which we have our freedom. If you're sitting in a Catholic mass, right, and you can't get up, you can't go out, you know, you're surrounded on all sides by your brothers and sisters, you're in the cry room, maybe. Were you ever in the cry room? I was always in the cry room. I don't even know if there's a French equivalent to the cry room.
What is the cry room?
The cry room is where the mothers with, like, a bunch of little kids would go because the kids would cry, and it was the cry room. So I was always in the cry room, and you had to be defining yourself against whatever stillness was in the air, whatever inertia, whatever lack of thought, whatever ritualized forms, whatever received language. You were defining yourself against these things. That was the rage you felt. That was the irritation. I mean, it becomes an incredibly productive thing for us, like later in our lives as adults. Not saying we should do this to our kids always, but it's how it turns out for a lot of us. And you don't necessarily have that discipline as an adult. It's not externally imposed on you. So you kind of have to do things for yourself. But for me, because I know I'm extremely responsive, it always starts with a book, right? So if I have my book in the morning and my caffeine, which I shouldn't have, but I have it anyway because it's necessary, because otherwise you have no thoughts and you're an idiot. If I have that in the morning, what happens is there will often be a line that opens up or some panel, some slit will open in the language and I'll start to see something. And when I have that feeling, you have to sort of let the book drop and then let the thing happen to you. So I think it doesn't always have to be boredom. There are also meditative spaces where you're doing real thinking and not just intake, right? You're not just like mindlessly sucking stuff in, but it's a meditative space of reading or contemplation of art. So it's not always stultifying, right? Sometimes it's just kind of like a peaceful calm where the mind can go on and let things happen to it.
Sorry. Thank you. We started tonight hearing that No One Is Talking About This was translated into a whole bunch of languages.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really curious if you've ever had the opportunity to talk to anyone who's read it for the first time in a different language, because it strikes me, I guess, kind of like poetry as a book that would have like a fairly fraught relationship to translation.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious if anything.
Yeah, we talked about this a lot. Like over the past week, I've been talking about this a great deal because I had the feeling with it that it would be okay with me if you're translating it into Hungarian or whatever, and you just kind of did Hungarian versions of the things that happen in the book that are specific to America. So there are things that are invented, but then there are also things that reference, you know, like a Ted Cruz tweet or something, like he accidentally faves like a porn link or something like that, and that's so specific. They don't know who Ted Cruz is. I don't want them to know who Ted Cruz is. So I thought, you know, if they just do their own version, that's fine. But for the most part, I just kind of let it go. So I feel like the first person I talked to that it was just translated in her language, and that's what she read, was like a Polish interviewer. And she talked about a couple things that were specific, but then she could also read the English. So most of the translators I talked to, because they can read both, you know, they have that. So I would like that, though. Like, 30 languages is a lot. You're almost like, do we need all of this? Do you need to know about that over there? But yeah, I don't feel like a strong feeling of possession with it. I think it would be cool if there were versions that were specific to different countries, and I would like to know more about that if those were the ones that existed. For the most part, what happened was either people would send you a lot of questions about it, or they would send you absolutely none at all, and I'm like, I'm glad that you know what you're doing. I'm glad that you feel really confident in this work. But a lot of times it would be like, you know, a Croatian person is like, what's Crosby, Stills, and Nash? And you have to be like, oh, what do I even, how do I even explain that to you? How do I translate that to a Croatian audience? So it was interesting. I would have liked maybe to be more involved, but then I also respected, I greatly respect translators' work, and was just kind of like, do your thing.
Other questions?
I feel that there's one, yes.
Yes.
I guess this is very personal to my recent reading experience, but I've been reading some novels written by poets who, like, previously were poets, and then they come out with a just stupendous novel. And I guess I'm both curious about two things. One is, do you still, I know you say you're very form-breaking, but do you still keep up kind of a poetry practice as such, maybe one that is not intended for publication? And then my other question is this a trend of, like, poets turning to novels?
Oh, we've always done that. No. I can qualifyingly, like, that's absolutely,
and
yeah.
Why are they so good?
It is because of the language. It really is. Also, a lot of times, it's because they're not that long. Because we know that you don't, like, push past 200 pages, right? But, I mean, we have, like, just a very strong tradition of those. You have, like, you know, you look at Rilke and you're not, he doesn't have to write a novel, but he does, and it's really good. It becomes a classic in its own right. As for secret poetry, yes. I do write secret poetry. It became for me probably because of Rape Joke. I mean, that's so public. The way it was disseminated was, you know, just lightning fast across the world, in every corner of the globe, like translated into all these languages. It just felt very exposing. And it really did feel like you existed in relation to it, that you would be introduced in relation to it. And then I think that I did have something where I retreated more into myself, and I began to write things that were private. But I was speaking to a Portuguese poet just before I came here, who the same thing really had happened to her. She had published a book in 2014 called Jockey in Portuguese, and like the attention she got was very focused on her face, on her personal life, that sort of thing. You know, she would go on the internet and like see a picture of herself or like some sort of discourse about her happening. It's very depersonalizing. So she did the same thing. She renounced poetry for a time, and she only writes for herself. So I would like to ask Ben Lerner, wouldn't you? Like, is he writing secret poetry? Because his novels really are fantastic. I was just reading Leaving the Atocha Station again, and I was like, damn, he can really do it. That is a funny frickin' novel. And then you're like, but are you secretly writing poetry? Because you do feel, if they begin that way, that it's pure of them to continue, right? You don't want them to give it up, renounce it, like Laura writing. You know, you want that pure space to continue. So I'm keeping it up, but it's secret for now.
Ben Lerner, if you're out there, if you're listening to
Ben,
this, send us an email.
Give it up.
Let us know. Put it in the Zoom chat. Other questions in the room?
Wait.
Can you share anything about your reading habits? We want to know everything or nothing, but
like who I read?
Yeah, and how you select. Are you beholden to the blurb machine? Woof. Are you reading more contemporary authors now that you're part of this pantheon?
I really don't read contemporarily. No. So since I write for the London Review of Books, what happens a lot of times is that I will embark on an author who has some meaning to me. I'm working on A.S. Byatt right now. She just passed away last year. And then since I lack a formal education, and since there is some conscientious Catholic thing inside me that wants to really cover all my bases, I go down the rabbit hole of everything that influenced that person, all of the work itself, the entire oeuvre, and then, you know, everything that's mentioned, everything that works upon this author. And it is exhausting, and it's very hard, and I don't always want to be doing it. But it constitutes an education, right? So I just go down the rabbit hole of what I want and need to be reading at that time. And I think that's very different from people who were educated in a more academic way. You probably have horror stories of things that you were forced to read that you did not wish to read. That's not been true in my life since high school. So I have this kind of passion or this feeling always that I want to be with a work that maybe people who had to read, you know, for study for years and years don't have. So it's always very fresh and always very enthusiastic. That being said, the way I read is somewhat strange. It's slow. A lot of times I will make errors that are like lyrical. I'll drop words down from one line to another. I'll transpose things dyslexically. And a lot of times these will give rise to ideas because I'm not reading, quote unquote, correctly, which has been very generative for poetry, even since I was a young child. I remember there's a David Berman poem that talks about, it's about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. And the line goes, "When the assassin was in midair, but when I read it, it read, when the assassination was in midair." And it was so much more interesting. And so if you have that sort of thing going on all the time, you can use those things, you can mark them down, and you can kind of like explode them a little bit and put them into your practice, right? Because a lot of times that's what poetry is, or that kind of language. It's like a little glitch, right, in what is accustomed. It's like the thing that you're not expecting, and that's how it happens.
Just listening to you now makes me think that your reading practice almost sounds a little bit like being on the internet, or this kind of the rabbit hole that you'd read one book which might lead to another, kind of like the Wikipedia spiral that sometimes I fall into after watching a film or whatever. And even typos, the glitch, which, you know, happens on the internet as well. And I was curious, are there other ways in which that kind of the internet as a genre, the internet as a particular style influences other practices, other creative practices?
I don't know about that, but I think you make an excellent point with, like, remember how in about 2011 to 2014, misspelling in a comic way was a huge thing. And I really loved to do that. And it just kind of passed away after a time. But it was part of it. It felt like what it was like for me to read. It felt like what was interesting to me about language, or sometimes what was funny. But no, the way I read in real life is almost like I'm going insane. It's hard to describe. It's like I'm breaking my brain against a rock. It's fascinating. Whereas, as you know, there's a kind of ease to internet reading where it's like you're not even reading. Your eyes kind of going down the middle of it and seeing maybe two words on either side. It's not exactly reading. As you know, when you read an article and you try to summarize points later on to your husband in bed, and he's like, "I read that article and it has nothing to do with what you're telling me right now." You're like, "Okay, maybe I didn't actually read it." So part of what's important for me about the act of physical books, not Kindle books, not iPads, is getting into that space where you're concretely reading every word, where your eye is not just going down the middle. I actually have a Kindle, and I do read on my Kindle in the bath, but it's like a paper white. So to me, in that's much closer to text. Yeah, it is really classy. It's like an old refurbed one. Yeah, I love it. No, because I mean, you can take it on a plane, and you can read 100 books on the plane, and you don't have to carry them all. No, Kindles definitely have their purposes. But I don't remember the books as well. I don't have sense memories of like what the books smell like, underlinings, things like that. I find that they're just not as concrete to me afterwards. So,
Can we have a final round of applause for Patricia, please?
Merci!